When looking at Parshat Noach, the story of the righteous man Noach and the world being destroyed by the flood, we encounter the personality of Noach as the Torah describes him, as an Ish Sadiq Tamim Hayab Daratav, a righteous person, a wholesome person within his generation. And yet, when we take a look at a very famous pasuk in Yeshayahu, and the way our rabbis understand this pasuk, we look at Noach from a slightly different perspective. The pasuk says, Ki mei Noach zot li, for this is to me as Noach's flood. And as Rav Chaim Shmulevitz quoting Chazal notes, that Chazal interpret this verse as implying that the flood was caused by Noach's shortcomings. By calling it mei Noach as Noach's flood, Chazal understand this, that this was a shortcoming of Noach. What's the shortcoming? So it continues that the shortcoming alluded to is that Noach did not pray for the world to be spared the ravages of the flood and was therefore responsible for its destruction. So although Noach was a righteous person and he was a Tamim Hayah B'Doratav, yet we find a certain implication about Noach which is not so positive. And that is that Noach had a certain responsibility to daven, to pray for his generation, and he didn't do so. And in not doing so, he's really, on a certain level, held responsible for the entire experience of the flood. The question that I'd like to try to deal with today, it's the question Rav Chaim Shmulevitz asked, is why indeed did Noach beseech God not to obliterate all of mankind? Where was Noach's mindset that we know that he tried to convince the people to do tshuva, and he spent, our rabbis tell us, 120 years building the ark. But what was it about Noach that he didn't daven for the people? That he didn't beseech God like Avraham and Stone, like Moshe Rabbeinu and Klal Yisrael. That he didn't beseech HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have pity on the people to save the world. And in not doing so, he's on a certain level held accountable for the results that happened. It's this question of why didn't Noach daven for the people that I think in examining perhaps an answer to this question, we will be able to unfold the whole mindset about Noach, and more importantly perhaps a whole mindset about ourselves as individuals, and to take a lesson from Noach for our own lives and our own interrelationship with the events in the world, and to draw a very powerful lesson for our lives. I'd like to begin our analysis with a fascinating essay by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which has been adapted by Rabbi Tauber in the book The Inside Story, where he notes that there are four individuals that we can look at through the progression of history that dealt with the interaction with the people around them on four different levels. The first is Chanoch, who walked with God. The second is Noah, who built the ark. The third is Abraham, who prayed for the people of stone. And the fourth is Moshe Rabbeinu, who beseeched the Kadosh Baruch Hu to forgive the people after the sin of the golden calf. And he notes in this essay that the progression from Chanoch through Noah through Abraham through Moshe gives us a sense of the progression in life of the development of humankind. I'd like to work through this essay because I think it has tremendous ramifications for our lives. In the introduction to this essay, he notes the following. He says, man by nature is a selfish creature. Even in his relationships with others, he tends to focus primarily on himself, or at most, on his self-colored perception of his fellow. Love is the endeavor to transcend this intrinsic selfishness and truly relate to one's fellow, to be sensitive to and devoted to his needs as an individual distinct of oneself and one's own stake in the relationship. And he continues by saying that love is not only about caring and giving, but it's also about influencing. And we note that when the Torah describes the command to love one's fellow man as oneself, it comes in the context of rebuking the person as well. And as he notes, one would not stand by as a loved one suffers hunger. Likewise, one cannot stand by while one fellow suffers from spiritual malnutrition or moral blindness. we need to respond with concrete and pragmatic steps to cure the spiritual ills. But here's the key. The selfishness and the influence of love are proportionate to each other. The selfless one's relationship with one's fellow, the more extensive one's influence will be upon that person. Conversely, the more your vision of your fellow and your involvement with him is defined by yourself and his self-colored perceptions, the less he will respond to your efforts on his behalf. And these four individuals that we mention are really four stages in the spiritual development of humanity, in the movement from the instinctive selfhood toward the complete giving up of self and self-interest in relating to others. And this is crucial, we know, in working with other people, that if we always have ourselves in mind and we always have our agendas in mind, so people aren't going to be so open to what we have to say. We need to be able to be selfless in dealing with other people and accepting them for who they are and dealing with them on that basis. Let's examine together these four individuals and have a sense of the progression that these four individuals take, which is really a reflection of humanity in general. The first is Chanoch, who we know lived at a time, he was a great-great-great-grandson of Adam. He lived at a time when humanity had succumbed to idolatry. Chanoch was the one who walked with God, but was wholly selfish. He was preoccupied only with the refinement and perfection of his own spiritual self. He disassociated himself from the people. And in fact, our rabbis tell us in the Medrash, he secluded himself in a cave. Not only did Chanoch fail to have a lasting impact on his society, but he was ultimately in danger of being influenced by their corrupt behavior, and therefore God took him to himself, and he only lived 365 years compared to the 900-year lifespan of his contemporary. Here, there was absolutely no relationship between Chanoch and the society around him. He completely secluded himself. Here is a person involved totally in self. Next, we encounter Noah, the builder of the ark. Noah, who was told that the end of all flesh has become before me, there's going to be a deluge of water on the earth, spends 120 years building the ark and calling out to his generation to mend its ways and avoid catastrophe. However, and I quote, the Zohar criticizes Noah for the fact that despite his efforts, he did not pray for the salvation of his generation, unlike Avram and Moshe, who pleaded with God to spare the wicked. This implies that ultimately it did not matter to Noah what became of them. Had he truly cared, he would not have sufficed with doing his best to bring them to repent, but would have implored the Almighty to repeal his decree of destruction, just as one who was personally threatened would never say, well, I did my best to save myself and leave it at that, but would beseech God to help him. In other words, Noah's involvement with others was limited to his sense of what he ought to do for them, as opposed to a true concern for their well-being. His self had sufficiently broadened to include the imperative to act for the sake of another, recognizing that the lack of a social conscience is a defect in one's own character, but he fell short of transcending the self to care for others beyond the consideration of his own righteousness. And that is really reflected in the fact that after 120 years of speaking to his generation, of trying to influence his generation, he had failed to win over even one single individual. In order to influence another, one's motives must be pure. In the words of our sages, words that come from the heart enter the heart. Deep down, a person will always sense whether you truly have his interests at heart or you're filling a need of your own by seeking to change him. If your work to enlighten your fellow stems from a desire to do the right thing, but without really caring about the result, your call will be met with scant response. The echo of personal motive, be it the most laudable of personal motives, will be sensed, if only subconsciously, by the object of your efforts, and will ultimately put him off. And we know this in terms of our relationships with other people. It is for sure true of a teacher-student relationship. When the student senses the agenda of the teacher, that the teacher only has their agenda in mind, and it's really not where the student is at necessarily, so the student's going to be very wary, usually, of buying into the system. a person has to know so clearly where one's motives are and why one is interested in trying to change another person. Noah, we see here, is faulted because he's trying to influence others because this is what he feels he has to do, not because this is really what he wants to do or that he really has the interest of the other at heart. Had Noah really been concerned for the others, for who they were, so he would have davened for them. If he had really been able to go beyond himself, as the Rebbe is explaining, so he would have been able to beseech God and he would not have just sufficed with trying to make the people repent. What's lacking here is a true concern for others. This is echoed in the Rav Chaim Shmulevitz himself in the Sichos Musar, when he gives the same answer of why Noach is held responsible. And he compares it to a very fascinating medrash. The medrash says that there were three people involved in the Egyptian decree against the Jewish people. Bilam conceived the plan, Eov kept silent, and Yitro protested and subsequently fled. But our rabbis tell us that Bilam, who devised it, was slain in battle. Eov, who silently acquiesced, was afflicted with suffering. And Yitro, who fled, merited having his children sit in the Sanhedrin. So the question is, why did Eov deserve to be so terribly afflicted on account of his silence? Yitro, who did protest, was singularly unsuccessful. And worse yet, he had to flee. Eov would have accomplished nothing by speaking out. So why was he punished? The understanding of this is that the purpose of the suffering that Eov underwent was not solely to punish him, but was rather to teach and point out to him his failings and wrongdoings. True, had he protested the decree against Israel, his advice would not have been taken, and his protest would have been of no avail. But neither for that matter are suffering's person's moans of any help, yet he continues to groan out and cry in pain. If Eov kept silent, it was an indication that Israel's suffering didn't really bother him. When in agony, one cries out. If he would truly have felt Israel's pain and affliction, he would have cried out in protest, much as he did for his own suffering. And this, too, was the case with Noah. Had Noah been concerned with the destruction of the world and its plight, he would have prayed regardless of whether he thought his prayers would succeed or not. The fact that he did not pray for his generation revealed a lack of concern for its destruction, and this is why it was named Noah's flood, decrying this very lack of concern. I think even before we move on to Abraham and to Moshe, we need to pause for a moment and to really try to integrate this lesson. If a person really cares, if a person is really concerned about others, if a person is really concerned about what's going on in the world and the suffering of other people, so a person cries out. When in pain, a person cries out, whether it will have an effect or not. Whether Noah knew or didn't know whether his davening would help. Whether Noah felt that the people were a lost cause, why bother davening? It's irrelevant. Our job is to cry out when we feel that there is somebody in pain. That has to be our perspective. The fact that Noah didn't cry out is symptomatic that he didn't really feel the concern of the people, that he wasn't able to go beyond himself. And this is really the lesson that we need to learn ourselves in our own lives, that if we really feel the concern and the pain that is going on in the world around us, so we cry out. If we're so self-absorbed and we're so involved in self, so that when we daven for our own needs, we daven for our own self, but we don't think about other people. We don't take other people into our prayers. And the real litmus test is that when we daven, we have to ask ourselves, did we daven when we said Shmoneh Esrei, did we also include other people in our prayers as well? Or are we only focusing in on ourselves? And this is the question that we have to ask ourselves. That when we daven, do we add in Shema Kolena that Kadosh Baruch Hu should think about, should have rachamim on the situation there in Israel, on the situation and the world around us? Or are we only preoccupied with asking for our own personal needs? These are the questions we need to ask ourselves. Do we say a Kapitul Tehillim for the world's problems every day, for the situation there in Israel? The lesson on the first level that Noach is teaching us is that if you're able to take the lesson of Noach, you're able to go beyond yourself. You're not only self-absorbed, you're not only thinking about self, but you're able to feel the pain of others. You're able to feel where other people are at, and to have that concern, which Noach is faulted for, which Noach was lacking, and hence was called May Noach, the flood of Noach. In returning to this essay of Lubavitcher Rebbe, I think we gain a sense of what is the model of concern for others. And that is to look at the two personalities of Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu. Continuing the essay, he speaks about Avraham Avinu, who we know came to recognize the Creator, and he devoted his life to bringing the belief and ethos of a one God to his generation. He concerned himself also with the more mundane needs of his people. And we find that the selflessness of Avraham's concern for his fellow is demonstrated by his daring intervention on behalf of the five sinful cities of Sodom and Amorah, where Avraham petitioned God on their behalf, and he said these cities should be spared for the sake of the few righteous individuals they might contain. And because people sensed that he had their own good and not had their own good and not only and only their own good at heart, they responded. And we find Torah tells us that Tanefesh Asher Subicharam, the souls which they made a charan, the community of men and women who had rallied to their cause. So Avraham Avinu is the next step. We have Chanoch, Noach, and Avraham. And we find here that Avraham does have the ability to daven for other people. He does have the ability to influence other people because he's involved in other people's interests, in their best interests at heart. But he adds something, and this is very fascinating. But even Avraham's love is still not the ultimate. It took another four centuries for the epitome of selfless devotion to one's fellow to emerge in the person of Moshe. Avraham's virtue over Noach was that his objective of relating to others lay not in realizing the potential of a social self, as was the case with Noach, but in achieving the desired result to transform their behavior and character, bringing to light their good and perfect essence. But therein also lies the limitation, so to speak, of Avraham's love. Ultimately, Avram's kindness had an ulterior motive. True, it was not a personal motive. True, it was a motive that spells the recipient's ultimate good, and is consistent with the recipient's true self. But it was an ulterior motive nonetheless. And we see this, that when Avraham had this tremendous hospitality, it was a means to achieve his goal of converting his guests to believe in God. That he said when they finished, "Thank you very much for the food. Don't thank me, but thank God." And on a deeper level, he was referring to the righteous one within the wicked person. His inner potential for good spared them when speaking about the city of stone. Avraham was saying perhaps the good in them will triumph yet. As soon as he became aware that the wicked of stone were beyond hope, he ceased his prayer. Such love and concern for the sake of the potential good that one sees in another is a love that is tainted, however minutely, with selfishness. One is relating to one's fellow not as one's fellow sees himself, but with an eye to one's own vision of him. And this allows for a reaction on his part, expressed, unexpressed, or even unconscious, that you don't care for me as I am only for what you wish to make of me. So you don't really care about me at all. True, only one's desire to reveal the other's essential self. And that's a deeper self. But this is deeper still unrealized self. When love fails to address the other as he is now, expressly is focusing instead on one's knowledge of what he latently is and what can and ought to make of himself. And that's why the highest level, so to speak, is Moshe Rabbeinu. Because in contrast, Moshe's love for his people was utterly selfless. It was an unconditional love. When he pleaded for the people, he said to them, "Forgive them," and that was it. He didn't say, "Forgive them because they'll repent. Forgive them before they carry great potential." He says, either forgive them, and if you don't, erase me from your Torah. Either you accept the sinner as he is, or put together a nation and a Torah without this Moshe. And that was the difference between Moshe and his predecessors. And you see this in the extent of the influence, where Chanoch influenced nobody. Noah, who extended himself to his fellows because he recognized that concern for one's fellows, an integral part of a perfect self, was not influenceable, but did not influence. Avram's teaching and instruction, free of personal bias, was embraced, but it fell short of this complete selflessness, and we find that his influence was correspondingly limited because we have no traceable heirs of the people that Avram converted. But the effects of Moshe, utterly selfish love, are eternal. His guidance and leadership of his people yielded a nation whose endurance and broken continuity to this very day defies all laws of history. And this is the key. The key is to love the person for where they are at, not necessarily with an eye on what they can be. The model of Avraham Avinu, as great as the model as it is save them for the righteous within them, for perhaps that righteousness will come to the fore. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu says, save them just for who they are, where they are at now, without even thinking about perhaps they'll repent, perhaps they won't repent. This is the utter selflessness, this ability of saying, Mecheni na mesifrecha, raise me from your book. This was the love that Moshe Rabbeinu exhibited to the people. And this, says the Rebbe, is the model that we need to follow. We need to move away from the Chanuch, away from the Noah, to transcend even the Avraham Avinu, as great as a level as that is, to the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, who's going to relate and thereby influence, and the influence is able to last because you relate to the person where they are at and deal with the person where they are at. The question becomes, how do we reach this level of Moshe Rabbeinu? How do we reach this level of this complete selflessness that we're able to give ourselves over to others and be able to deal with others where they are at? And the answer to this question is clearly by working on oneself. It's first having to understand self and where one is at, that then one is able to transpose that in terms of relationships with others. And I think we can perhaps suggest two areas, two aspects that we need to work on to be able then to reach the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. And both of these areas can be seen through the prism of the life of Noach. The first is a fascinating essay by Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirim. Rabbi Miller speaks about that Noach, the pasuk about when Noach sends the orev, the raven, to see whether the land had dried up or not. And the pasuk says, and he sent forth the raven, which went out to and fro until the water was dried up from the earth. And Rashi, in one of the two Agadic comments, notes that what's this phrase, to and fro? So it's interpreted as going around and about the ark in circles. The raven did not go on its errand to seek out dry land, says the Talmud, because it suspected Noach of designs on its mate. The obvious question is how Noach, the very emblem of morality in his generation, could conceivably have been suspected of such a perverted desire. And the second question is, why send it? If we know that the raven is an unclean and cruel animal, why was this the animal that Noach sent out specifically after the flood? As the Medrash says, Vayishlach et harev hahu dichtiv shalach choshech vayachshich. If one sends darkness, it induces greater darkness, which means one should not send an unworthy messenger. So why was it that Noach sent this animal? So it's a fascinating Yalkut Ruveni, where the Medrash says, Rabbi Chiya said, why did he send the raven? And it's an indication that God, who is merciful, had become cruel like a raven. A very fascinating insight. Says the Medrash that Noah was sending the raven really as a symbol to God. We know that the raven is one of the cruelest of all animals. It was as if Noah was saying to Kadosh Baruch Hu, you were also cruel in destroying the world. How could you have sent a mubble, a flood, to destroy all of humanity? You are acting, kivyachol, like this raven with such cruelty. Such was Noah's motive in sending the raven. He was complaining to the Almighty himself. Nonetheless, Noah was chided by God for his belated concern for mankind. As we see in a subsequent paragraph, in the same Medrash, which says the following: and Noah went out from the ark, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Our rabbis taught, what did God reply to Noah? When he went out of the ark and saw the world destroyed, he began to weep. Master of the world, he cried, thou art called merciful. Why did thou not have mercy on thy creatures? And God replied to him, foolish shepherd. Now you have spoken thus, but not when I told you that I was about to bring a flood upon the earth. And as soon as you heard that you would be saved in the ark, the destruction of the world no longer troubled your heart. On perceiving this, Noah at once offered sacrifices to God. And here Rabbi Miller, in understanding these two midrashim, says something very powerful. And this becomes for us concept number one to reach the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. The psychological insight of this midrash is of general validity. It was Noah's own guilty conscience which led him subconsciously to accuse another, in this case God, of a fault in himself. This accords with the famous Talmudic dictum, whoever disqualifies, disqualifies with his own blemish. When Noah is sending out that raven and saying that Kadosh Baruch Hu, you acted cruelly, the Kadosh Baruch Hu's response is, where were you, Noah, before the flood? What he's saying is, Noah, you're really talking about yourself. You recognize in retrospect that you behaved perhaps a little bit too cruelly, that you didn't understand the need to daven for others, that you didn't understand the need to beg the Rachmanis, to beg the mercy at this time. And using the same maxim, the Marashal explains the raven's suspicion of Noah. The raven itself, according to the Gemara, did not adhere to the prohibition against cohabitation with its mate during the flood. The reason for the prohibition was that those who were safe should not indulge in their own pleasures, while the rest of the world was in the throes of destruction. The raven, a symbol of cruelty and unenlightened self-interest, was not concerned at the sufferings of the outside world and transgressed the prohibition. Having itself sinned in this manner, it at once suspected Noah, too, a sinful lust. Though, as a matter of fact, Noah was the only man free from such guilt. And this is the lesson that we learn. Thoughts which lie in your own heart concerning others, you're apt to impute to those others. A person's bitterness at his own fate and his criticism of the characters of others often stems from the unwillingness to probe himself. Instead of seeing his own fault in others or blaming God, let him examine himself honestly and mend his own ways. And this is the key of idea number one, that when we're talking about reaching a level of Moshe Rabbeinu, it has to be with an honesty of self. It has to be with working on the midos of oneself. And this, when Noach is accusing Kadosh Baruch Hu kivyachol, it really is a mirror of self-reflection, where he has to look inside himself and says, perhaps he acted a little bit too cruelly. The way to work on moving beyond the self is to be able to have that openness of looking at self. This idea of working on self, of being honest with self, of working on one's midos before relating to others and showing this concern for others, is developed very beautifully in Rebbetzin Heller's book, This Way Up. And she notes the following. She says, we tend to resist moving beyond our midos comfort zone. The almost paranoid fear of being taken advantage of is one of the most pervasive dreads of 20th century secular society. The hidden suspicion that lending a neighbor an egg may, heaven forfend, lead to lending a cup of sugar, and from there the possibilities are unlimited, has led to certain reluctance for some people to develop relationships with their neighbors. Needless to say, it's certainly an uphill battle for any couple to maintain a reasonable level of shalom bayis when apprehension of fear of being taken advantage of replaced trust in the marriage. What are we actually afraid of? After all, we can always lend the egg and stop at that fragile and priceless family heirloom. It is possible to go as far as assuming that an error of sight of giving may result in being brought closer to each other, which is what we want most deeply inside. So she says, and this is the key, the fear is that somehow we will lose ourselves. Our sense of our own significance on a deep and authentic level has been so degraded by our times and our own insecurity. The times in which we live are so superficial and consumer-oriented that giving away anything tangible at all leaves one feeling as though he has somehow compromised his value of a person. After all, if his worth as a person can be determined by possession, he would need a very good reason to part with him. In a similar vein, if his significance to a spouse is measured by how much the other gives rather than how much he gives his spouse, then the smallest compromise is a degradation. The fact is, of course, that our human worth is determined neither by possessions nor by the ability to dominate. It is resolved day by day as we choose to give the divine spark within us articulation. We can't lose ourselves. The soul within us is eternal. The more we fear losing ourselves, the more we suppress the side of ourselves that is attached. We come to understand that we are far more than the sum total of our possessions. We also realize that we are similarly not defined by the degree to which we can preserve ourselves by retreating from giving. What is left under the surface is the stuff from which our character, our form, our midos. The midos are the means of getting to know the spark of God within us. They are the foundation from which all of our access to the higher part of us stems. This is really what midos is about. Midos is about understanding ourselves, who we are, that godly spark within us. This is something that can never be taken away from us. If we have a deep sense of self, we have an understanding, a security, a self-esteem of that which makes us special, that which makes us unique, and that which is something that can be never taken away from us, so then we have the confidence to deal with other people in this regard, that we're not always insecure, we're not always afraid that we're going to lose ourselves. When we have this fear, so then we try to change the whole world into ourselves. If we know who we are, if we know what we are made of, if we understand so clearly what are the midos within us, so then this understanding gives us the self-confidence to relate to others. Just to give one example, the way she develops this, she speaks about the Tanya that speaks about that the nature of our midos can be understood using the paradigm of the physical, of the four physical elements that make up the world. The fire, the wind, the water, and the earth, these correspond to four spiritual elements. And to take one example where we see the development of this idea and the crucial need to really be connected with self, is she says the following: the nature of fire is to ascend to its source. The core of the Mida of fire is our longing for significance. Its negative manifestation is arrogance, which is, as we know, far too often the fruit of insecurity and one's sense of significance. Invariably, anger is an inseparable partner of insecurity, as any affront is seen as a statement about one's lack of significance. And this leads to an overdeveloped sensitivity to one's own piece of the pie. Any insult, no matter how minor, is a slur on one's importance. The only way the insatiable need for ascent can be assuaged, even briefly, is by momentary dominance over others. The positive manifestation of the Smita is humility, and it's not by accident we know that Moshe Rabbeinu was a paradigm of humility. The fire of one's character can be redirected, and one's sense of meaning and significance can be defined by the degree to which one is truly aware of the other people with whom one is interacting. Being there in the fullest sense for the other person validates one's own significance. Learning to see others in this light causes one to replace anger and envy with responsiveness. And this is the key. If you have that sense of self, if you have that ability to be rooted, then when one interacts with others, one is open for responsiveness, not for anger and for envy. And this is the way we need to understand in dealing with other people. When we look at the world around us and we interact with people around us, be it friends, be it family, be it the society around us, if we're always interested in imposing our will on others, so A, we know we'll always be unsuccessful, but B, we have to understand that it's really stemming from a desire of our own insecurity, that we need to define the world from our vantage point. Prerequisite number one for the selflessness of Moshe Rabbeinu, this midah of Moshe Rabbeinu, is to work on one's midos, to work on one's character traits, to ask oneself when one deals in a situation, what part of me is coming out here? Is it the good part? Is it the healthy part? Is it the ego? What is it that's playing out here? If one has the ability to know oneself and have the sensitivity in dealing with others, the responsiveness to others, so then one will then be able to look at another for who they are. It's the paradigm of Moshe Rabbeinu, who refuses to go on a Kadosh Baruch Hu's mission when asked, because he says, I don't want to slight my brother, who's older than me, who perhaps will feel bad that he wasn't chosen. This is someone from moment go who has that sensitivity to others. Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe goes out, and what's the first thing he does? Vayar b'siv lotam. He sees the pain of the people. This is the model that we need to understand, that somebody can move beyond self because it has an understanding of self. And this is prerequisite number one. The model we learn comparing Noach and Moshe, that you have to be able to know where you're at in order to be able to deal with others. And to be able to look and examine oneself, and instead of accusing a Kadosh Baruch Hu of being cruel, to be able to recognize that the cruelty was really a function within self for not davening for the people. And then to be able to deal with the people where they are at. Prerequisite number one is working on midos, is asking ourselves those basic questions. What is moving us in this world? Is it the I? Is it the self? Or do we have enough of that self-stability that we then can deal with others on their terms, on their turf, and not trying to influence and project ourselves on others? The second aspect, which is really dovetails with the first, is found in the Sefer Ben HaMishpatayim, which quotes the Medrash, which says the following. The Medrash says, Amar Rabbi Brechia, Chaviv Moshe Minoach. Moshe is more beloved than Noach. Noach, Mishnikra Ish Tzadik, Nikra Ish Adama. Noach originally is called an Ish Tzadik, a righteous person. But then later on, when he goes out after he leaves the ark, the Torah tells us that this man, Noach, plants a vineyard. And the Torah tells us Noach began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. And we know he drank some of the wine, made himself drunk, uncovered himself in the tent, and what transpired because of that. So the Medrash says that originally he's called an Ish Tzadik, a righteous person, and then he's called an Ish Adama, a man of the earth, a man of the soil. Aval Moshe, Mishinikra Ish Mitzri, Nikra Ish Elokim. But Moshe Rabbeinu, on the other hand, is originally called an Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man, and then he's called an Ish Elokim, a man of God. We see clearly the difference, Noah going from a high level down to a low level, while Moshe Rabbeinu is the opposite, becomes elevated. So in the Sefer he notes, what's the difference? He says, Upeirush hadavar sha'adam lo nivra bishvil shi'amod v'makom achad. This is such an important fundamental principle. Man was not created to stand in one place. The Yisodo shel Ha'adam and the fundamental aspect of man, Harehu Mehalech V'lo Omeid Bimkomo, a person constantly has to be in process. A person constantly has to grow. What was the problem of Noah? Noah was a righteous person. He was a great person. But he was satisfied in his righteousness and his greatness. Just like he wasn't able to have that empathy to go beyond for the people, that is really reflected in his whole character, that he was very much caught up in self but wasn't able to transcend that, to constantly grow and to constantly be able to become greater and greater. And perhaps this is the understanding of those who interpret it for positive and for negative of Bedorotav. In his generation, he was righteous. Because yes, he was a righteous person, and yes, he was an Ish Tzadik Tamim Haya. He was righteous, he was whole. But Bedorotav comes to limit him in terms of he was missing, he was at fault. Although he was great, there was a fault inherent in this as well, and that he wasn't a person who was involved in constant growth. He wasn't able to influence others. He wasn't able to project his teaching on others and constantly be involved and the growth process. And that's the negative part. And that is what we understand. What does it mean that he was an Ish Tzadik and yet he was an Ish Adama? An Ish Adama means somebody who's drawn to the earth. Somebody who has this downward pull, this gravitational pull downward. This was the aspect of Noah. Vayichal lashon chulin, that when he began to plant this vineyard, it was a shortcoming. And again, this is the whole concept. Why did he plant a vineyard and not wheat or something that all of humanity could have used? Because he was involved in self-pleasure to a certain level and not being able to extend outwards, not being able to be involved in the growth process. That's the Isha Adama. He's being pulled downward rather than being pulled upward. This is the great lesson we learned from Noah. That although Noah was great, and we mentioned his chus in the tefillah of Rosh Hashanah, but the problem was he wasn't involved in constantly growing and influencing other people likewise in this way. And this lesson, he says, is so important. Says the Ben HaMishpatayim, quoted the Saba of Kelm, who once said to his students, Yiladim al tichyu be'ofen pashut, don't live a simple life, because if you live with simplicity, you'll remain simple. That even if you do the mitzvot, and even if you daven, but your whole life is just to be satisfied with this level, so you're never going to go anywhere in life. Your learning, your davening, has to be about a springboard to grow further and further in your relationship with God. You know, the second prerequisite in becoming a selfless person is to constantly work on oneself. Before one goes to sleep at night, to ask oneself, was I a better person today than I was yesterday? How have I grown? How have I changed? How have I developed? What have I learned today that will make me a different person that I didn't know yesterday? How can I integrate that knowledge? How can I integrate that interaction with another person into my life? Somebody said something to me. I saw something happen. I experienced something. I myself went through either something positive, a success, a failure. How has that influenced? How can I integrate that into myself? If you're not able to constantly examine and to constantly grow, so then you're always going to remain in Ish Pashut, and you're going to have this downward pull, because if you're not moving upward, you're automatically moving downward. The difference about Moshe Rabbeinu was he went from an Ish Mitzri to an Ish Elohim. He was constantly involved in that upward pull. You want to know how you can grow into being a selfless person? It's not going to happen overnight. Yes, you have to work on your midos, but you also have to work on constantly growing, on constantly examining the situation and saying, how could I have done it better? How can I grow from the situation? And I think you see this really in the words themselves. Noach is this concept of respite, of relaxation. If you have this attitude of life of a Noach, so you'll be an Ish Adama, you'll be pulled downward. If you have the attitude of an Ish Mitzri, of somebody in constant turmoil, somebody in straits, someone constantly grappling and growing, so then you can be an Ish Elohim, you can be a man of God. Therefore, in summary, I think what we've seen today with our original question of why indeed didn't Noach daven, and indeed he's faulted for not davening, was on Noach's level, as great as he was, as much as he was involved in the perfection of self, of tamim, he was really whole, he was really perfect. He's somebody whose chus, whose merit we mention in Rosh Hashanah. On the level of Noach, we would have demanded from him an ability to go beyond the self, to transcend the self, to have that sensitivity for others, to be able to pray for others. On the level, really, as a model of Moshe Rabbeinu, where the others may be at. Although we may want to influence others, we want to impact others, we have to understand and accept where others are at and deal with them on that level without them understanding our personal agendas. How do we get to this level of Moshe Rabbeinu? We saw two ways. One is working on midos, working on oneself, having the confidence of self, of knowing that I have the spark of God within me that will never be taken away from me, and I'm able to deal with that spark with others as well. And the second is the constant working on oneself in terms of always growing, moving from the Ish Mitzri to the Ish Elohim, not the Noach, who is the Ish Tzadik, into an Ish Adama. And on a very practical level, we have to ask ourselves, when tragedy happens, when sickness happens, are our hearts open to pray constantly for them? When you hear about people getting together to say Tehillim or Machzom Lefi, do we join up? are we able to transcend the self in our own personal lives to be able to go out and extend ourselves for others? And on the second level, are we constantly looking at ourselves to improve, to grow? Are we satisfied and apathetic with the level we are on? The model of Noach is a model of transcending self. It's a model of moving out of the ark to the open doors of Avraham Avinu and openly to the and ultimately to the expanse of the all-encompassing Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu.